All right, so today we have Hamel Hussein, founder at Parlance Labs, and an author of a new report entitled AI Essentials for Tech Executives. So Hamel, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here.
So you and your collaborators have been pumping out fantastic content aimed at practitioners and people who are trying to build off of all of this fantastic work that the foundation model builders are producing. So I guess the first question is, Hamel, so what inspired you and your co-authors to create this series on practical usage of foundation models, specifically LLMs, and what gap in the existing resources did you aim to address?
Yeah, so earlier, we have that AI for Executives that we're publishing now. Last year, me and a bunch of colleagues, we published a work with O'Reilly called What We Learned from a Year with Building from with LLMs. And that was quite popular. And the common theme between both of them is coming from the perspective of a machine learning engineer and data scientist in terms of what you need to know while building with AI. And the reason that's interesting is, okay, you don't need to build models. You don't need to train models because you can just use an API. However, there's still certain skills and practices from data science, they're absolutely crucial. And that's what people are getting stuck on. And that's the kind of education that seems to be missing. A lot of the education does focus on how to use tools, how to glue them together, different frameworks, so on and so forth, how to use a RAG database, how to do function calling, things like that. But there's some core skills around data analysis, error analysis, and just basic data literacy that you need to go beyond a demo to really make AI work, even if you're not training a model. And so that is where this content is coming from. And, that's the kind of unique angle that we're sort of bringing to the table.
And actually, you also independently wrote some related or accompanying posts on your blog. And so if you were to just, these posts are long, and I encourage the readers to read them, and we will make sure to put links to them in the episode notes. But maybe just give us some high-level themes and practical takeaways, or I guess another way to get at this is, so what are some crucial shifts in mindset that you and your collaborators would like to relay to our listeners?
So me and my collaborators, so again, there's this group of people, and we can include the authors in the show notes of these various works. Like I said, they all have some kind of machine learning engineering, data science background. And the phrase we keep repeating is look at your data. So what does look at your data mean? It's not just, it can feel trivial to say that, look at your data, but there's this process that you should use to look at your data. And so, with machine learning systems have a lot of commonality with, AI, like modern AI, even though, you're not training models, there's still stochastic systems that you have to reason about. So how do you test those? How do you debug them? How do you improve them? And so there's a lot of things that we've learned there. And one of the biggest things is look at your data. So people really fail on this because what they do is, they build their AI apps, they hook up their LLMs, and then they kind of use their own products, maybe do some vibe checks, but they don't really know where to go after, like what to do next. Like, what do you do now? It's like, hey, like, RAG is not quite working as well as I want. The LLM sometimes makes mistakes. Okay, you can keep changing the prompt, but then people feel stuck. They're like, they just feel like they're endlessly changing the prompt and they're not sure they're fixing one thing and breaking another thing. And so looking at your data as the first step helps ground everything. And it's kind of counterintuitive to a lot of people. They're like, what do you mean look at data? And really what it means is look at actual logs of user interactions. If you don't have users, there's ways to synthetically generate user interactions and see the way your AI is behaving and write detailed notes about the failure modes and sample. There's different ways to do, and this is called error analysis, very basic technique for machine learning. It's just a fancy way of saying, like, look at your data carefully, note down what's going wrong. And then from those notes, like, do some data analysis on those notes, like categorize those notes, count which ones are happening more often than not. And you'll start to see patterns. Like, you'll start to see, like, what your biggest failure modes are. And that will give you a sense of what to prioritize, how to fix those things, and then, like, will allow you to focus on how to measure and what to measure. And so a lot of people are missing that, I think, because there's a lot of software engineers who are building AI, but there's not, you know, a combination of data literacy and tools. You know, for people that are full stack engineers might not have access to the rich ecosystem or be familiar with the rich ecosystem of data tools, you know, that maybe data scientists have. And so they get stuck. They're like, okay, I don't really know how to analyze this data, how to look at it. It can be counterintuitive. It's also counterintuitive because it can feel daunting, right? It's like you're standing on a beach and you're trying to pick up one grain of sand at a time. It can feel like, what do you mean look at data? Like, how is that ever going to help me? It seems very manual. But we know from machine learning that it's absolutely crucial to sample some data and look at it. You learn an incredible amount. So that's like the most important mind shift. It seems trivial, but most people don't do it. And it's also really important that you have the domain expert do it with the engineers. It's not just, oh, this is all an engineering task. Let me outsource it to some offshore Q&A team to look at my data. No, it has to be the domain expert that's looking at that. And a lot of teams, that's not the engineer. It's someone else. Unless you're building developer tools or something like that. Like you're building Copilot, Cursor, you know, something else. Like, okay, you are the domain expert and the developer. Great. So that's the biggest mind shift. And then really, like, overall, it's focusing on processes, not tools, is another thing we teach. So what I mean by that is we talk about measuring AI efficacy or doing evals. It's not like evals doesn't, the word evals, so evals is just a technique. It's not, you know, it's not the problem. The problem is your AI is not working as good as you want it to. And so evals are just one thing to think about and a very central thing to think about. But it's not a vendor problem. It's not like just plug in tools and the tools will take care of it for me. You know, a lot of people think that way. They're like, okay, this all of AI, all of it is mostly a tools problem. So, you know, the evals must be a tools problem too. Let me start shopping for vendors. And they plug in the vendor and it doesn't really do anything. It's like buying a gym membership and thinking that's going to solve your problem. No, it's the process of actually going to the gym and going to the right process. So there's a whole process involved. It doesn't matter what vendor you're using, or even if you have a vendor at all, is a process of like how to debug, look at, and measure AI and create a flywheel. So those are the main sort of mind shifts that I see and that we take our clients through at Parlance Labs when they come to us and they're stuck on AI.
Yeah. So actually, those are all fantastic points. And especially in the context of what you said earlier, which is most people these days are actually not doing, are building models, so what they call pre-training. A lot of them might be doing what's called post-training, doing things after you have a base model. But it turns out that there's still a lot, as you point out, Hamel, there's a lot of experiments that you might still have to run, like, you know, not just the prompts, like maybe I use another model or whatever, right? So there's knobs that you have to turn, and without the ability to do it systematically and measure, you might not actually be capturing all the learnings that you may need, and you're just mindlessly turning knobs without actually learning much.
Absolutely. A lot of people, so I held open office hours for over a period of a few months, you know, and I invited everyone to just come and ask me questions about evals. And by far, the thing that people struggle with the most is what to eval. There's so many different components. Like you said, Ben, there's RAG, there's function calling, you might have routers. There's almost infinite components in some systems in terms of what to test.
Hamel, even within RAG, right? So what's the chunking? What's the embedding, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you can't test everything. You shouldn't test everything. You should be grounded in what your actual failure modes are and what errors are you seeing. And then essentially prioritize your tests on that. And so that's, you know, that's really the mind shift that has to occur.
Okay, so then another topic I wanted to talk to you about is what I refer to as, the prototype purgatory.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, a lot of people have great demos and the demos work. Maybe they even might be able to deploy it in a limited way internally because maybe the stakes are lower if it's just internal users. But I think a lot of people, Hamel, struggle with just pulling the trigger to really go outward facing with some of these things. So what are some of your key pieces of advice to people?
One thing you can do, a lot of people don't know how to evaluate their AI systems if they don't have any users. Like, let's say you're just in the prototype phase and you're like, well, I don't really know how this is going to perform in production. And one way you can help yourself get over the hump, I mean, you have to take the leap of faith eventually. But one thing that you can do that, you know, really helps is you could generate synthetic data. So for example, you can have an LLM generate realistic user inputs into your system. And you can brainstorm different personas, scenarios, so on and so forth. And I've written about this in some of my blog posts of like how to generate synthetic data. And really it's, once you learn it, it feels like common sense, but it's like you think about, okay, what are the different personas and scenarios or features or tools that you want to test and the combination thereof, and use an LLM to help you generate realistic synthetic inputs that a user might generate. And really, you know, perturb your system as much as possible and observe the behavior. And that bootstraps you significantly towards production, like when you're starting out, because you can get an idea of where things might fail. Of course, there's the unknown unknowns, like you don't know what people are going to do that you're not thinking of. But at least for your intended use case, you have some way to, you know, to do things.
So I hate to say this, but I just came across a tool. I know you might not be a fan of tools, but there's a new open source tool that does something like this for agents in particular. But it's along these lines. It's called Intel Agent. But it basically helps you generate the types of synthetic data that you may not be able to come up with yourself, like Hamel was pointing out, right? So edge cases. And it'll do basically kind of a pen test almost on your agent to make sure that you're really pushing its capabilities. But Hamel, let's tie this a little bit to your new book for executives. As you know, executives are chomping at the bit to deploy, right? And then so now you have the technical teams, the product teams, but increasingly legal and compliance are also in the mix. So What are some of the things you're hearing in the field about this need to deploy and need to be careful at the same time?
Yeah, it's really, do you have a way to measure your system that you trust? That's the key thing. One mistake that people make is they'll buy some framework or they'll use some vendor and they use off-the-shelf eval. So off-the-shelf evals, and they'll have a dashboard, a fancy dashboard with a bunch of metrics, hallucination score, usefulness score, conciseness score, you just name it.
There's tons of open source projects as well, right? So
yeah, tons of open source projects, and you can get these off-the-shelf evals and put them on a dashboard and feel like you're measuring a whole bunch of stuff. But at the end of the day, like, number one, most of that is not going to correlate with anything with your most critical problems. Second, it causes lots of noise. Third, people don't trust that stuff half the time because you haven't gone through the process of, like, looking at your data, finding out what your errors are, having metrics that you understand that correlate to actual issues that you've seen. And so, you know, like, these metrics are being sold to executives. And executives are sometimes, you know, in their first go around, they often get fooled. They say, okay, like, this AI is too complicated. These metrics, I don't really understand them. They, like, have this dashboard. Engineers try to explain it. And then you go in and then you learn really fast, like, hey, no bullshit metrics. Show me metrics that actually make sense to me as an executive that I understand. And, you know, that is an alignment that happens. But people take a long time to get there. So, you know, there's that, for example. Like, I'll give you an example. I was working with a talent platform. It's a very, like, popular one. And, you know, it's kind of like LinkedIn, but it's not LinkedIn. And basically, one of the products are for recruiters that help people reach out to candidates. And it helps, there's a Gen AI feature that helps draft the email. And one of the metrics being reported to the executive or the executive team was edit distance. Like, okay, when this email is generated, like, how, you know, basically, what is the edit distance between the email that was sent by the human versus the one generated by the AI? But the thinking is the less edits, the better. Seems reasonable, right? If engineer, like, tells you about this metric. However, when looking at the data, we found that the edits being made, there were a lot of times the recruiters were non-native English speakers. They were, like, overseas, and they were making edits that made no sense. They were making things dramatically incorrect. And so, you know, that's kind of like what happens when you don't look at data and you don't have metrics that align with, you know, your business. It's like you end up with these other metrics that, you know, don't make sense.
Now, actually, one thing that my friends at Luminos.ai pointed out is actually, given the fact that now you might also have other teams involved, it's not just even executives and technical teams, but the legal teams, right? So it turns out that this is an increasingly comical problem in some ways, because the legal and technical teams don't necessarily have a way to work together nicely. So they tend to use things like Google Docs or Google Spreadsheets. So a scenario like this, right? So a data scientist might ask, is it okay to deploy my model? And the lawyer will say, well, it depends. Tell me, preferably in writing, so I can carefully review it. And then the data scientist will say, okay, let me get back to you. And then that may take a week, right? So then the lawyer gets the information. Maybe the lawyer looks at it. That takes another 2 weeks, right? So, and then the lawyer will say, so we'll ask questions like, who reviewed the training data? Who did you ever test for this thing? Let me get back to you. That's another 3 weeks. You know? So basically, and most of that is happening in Google Docs right now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. We've been dealing with this problem in machine learning for a really long time. I would say before generative AI, before the generative AI boom.
But the difference now, Hamel, is more people are building AI stuff because it's becoming more democratized, right? So
yeah, everyone's facing it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I joke with my colleagues that a lot of problems are not AI problems, and they're not technical problems at all. They're just organizational problems. You know, yeah, like, you know, bureaucracy and not being able to communicate across teams, you know, is definitely a problem. One of the things we talk about in our book.
Or common language even, right?
Yeah. One of the things we talk a lot about in the AI Execs book is using plain English language wherever possible. So, and you know, so let me give you an example. Instead of saying RAG,
you mean not ROC curves?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so like, there's a lot of, like, give you some examples of terms that people throw around. Like one is agents. People love saying the word agents, even if the job to be done is writing a prompt. And that's the only thing you have to do. If you say I'm building an agent, people don't know what you're doing. So like if you're in a room with, so I was like, okay, I was working with an education startup, and you know, there's all kinds of people in the room. There's engineers, there was a learning specialist, people like really good at designing education, things like that. And you know, people were talking past each other with the word agent, like I'm going to build an agent that does XYZ, but really the job needed to be done was write a prompt, and writing the prompt is completely within the domain of a non-technical person because it's English, you know what I mean? But they don't know that because you're just saying agent all the time, and it looks like it feels beyond them. And this is what happens like everywhere, like, you know, lawyers to, you know, psychologists, like mental health companies, like same, you know, I've seen that happen there. Like it happens everywhere. And what happens is it alienates non-technical people for no reason at all. Because a lot of the LLM, like the magic of LLMs is it makes things accessible via English language to lots of people. And by using jargon where it's not necessary, you actually destroy communication, you know, within your teams. It's a subtle point, but it makes a huge difference. Because when you say, oh, I'm going to write a prompt, or instead of saying RAG, if you say, hey, I'm going to make sure the model has the right context so it can answer questions correctly. Or instead of saying prompt injection, you say, I'm going to make sure users can't trick the model into doing what it's not supposed to do. People understand, and you can bring all more domain experts, and more people will be able to like collaborate with you. Whereas using too much jargon, like it just takes forever to communicate, and it just exacerbates the bureaucracy you may already have, let's say.
This is such a good point. Actually, this is even a frustrating point even within the technical world, because especially now with agents being so popular, people are using different terms for different aspects of the agent stack, let's say. And so, and everyone is trying to promote some sort of new term.
Exactly, yeah.
And then it turns out, well, I guess this is all you mean, right? So and then it's just frustrating. So I can imagine when you now cross different functional areas and personas, it gets even more frustrating.
Yeah. So if you recall, you know, let's say a decade ago, people would always say, I'm going to use big data. And when you heard that term, you immediately knew deep down inside that, like, you don't know what they're talking about, right? Like, they could be talking about anything. Like,
that's
yeah.
Great for me. That's my handle on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, okay, I'm going to use big data to solve this problem. It's like, there's a lot of questions like, do you really need big data? How much data we're talking about? Whatever. Like, we don't, it was so nebulous, right? There was almost no information in that term whatsoever. And it's kind of, agents is a little bit of an example of that. It's like, at least right now, is very nebulous. People love saying the word. You know, it can be helpful in certain contexts, but certain contexts, it can hurt because if you obfuscate the jobs to be done. Yeah, so it's good to think about that when communicating.
Yeah. So obviously you've been around this machine learning space for many, many years, right? So nowadays, for example, so if someone is in school or about to graduate, what they need to know is completely different from what we had to know back in the day, right? So do you have any specific pieces of advice to our listeners who are just starting out their career?
You know, I think about this all the time. I'm not sure I have the best answers. I have two children, a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old. I also think about what they should do. I'm not 100% sure. Except, you know, learn how to use AI, integrate it into your life, use it to learn more, learn how to learn effectively, learn new skills, like, you know, with AI as a coach where possible. And just integrate it to your everyday life. It's really hard to predict like what, you know, jobs will be secure or whatever. I don't have a good answer. I don't know if I know the answer to that. All I know is like, hey, you know, you have to learn new things constantly, and being able to, you know, use AI to learn those things is helpful. So like just practicing using it every day. It sounds simple, like of course everyone's going to practice using it every day, but actually I find that a lot of people don't, you know? They don't think about integrating it into the workflow and everyday life as much as they can. And it's a good skill to have.
Where do you stand on still going to college, let alone grad school, right? So, because nowadays, I was joking with a friend the other day. I said, you know, a few years ago, I started running into founders who were born after 9/11. But now you're starting to run into founders who are not even allowed to drink, right? So because they're too young. Because they go to school for a year and then they decide, this space AI is moving so fast, I've just got to go out there. And I don't want to sit in a classroom anymore. So make the case for or against a 4-year degree?
That's a really good question. I feel like the value proposition, so there's a lot of factors. I feel like, okay, for one, the cost benefit ratio of higher education has been shrinking over time, primarily because of the costs.
Especially if you go to like one of these expensive private schools, right?
Yeah, but even like any school, even a state school, I mean, you name it, the cost has been going through the roof. There's a like some point where, I mean, it's not infinite value, right? So you have to think like, and it's kind of at that point where it does make me pause, like, wow, okay, this is a significant amount of money. And it does make me, it's almost like nowadays to prepare yourself for college, like if you want to get into competitive university, you have to be so good that you don't even need to go to that university. Does that make sense? Like you have accomplished so much. You have learned so much that like it doesn't, like just getting into the university was basically just a stamp, but you're already there. Like
you're already a self-motivated self-learner.
Yeah, you're already self-motivated. You're already really smart. Probably know lots of material already, which is why they accepted you. And so like, it's interesting, right? It's like, well, yeah, that's why a lot of people drop out of college and start companies, because they kind of didn't need to do it. So what I would say is like, it's interesting. I feel like you should strive to be like that person and then maybe not go to college. Like, I think, you know, but yeah, because, you know, it's really the learning and the grit that gets you a long way. So it's not, you know, it's really interesting. Like almost like preparing to go to college is like extremely valuable in the abstract sense. Even if you don't want to go, just going through that exercise of like doing that much learning, having that many, you know, interesting life experiences, especially at a young age. But yeah, it's hard for me to like completely just blanket say don't do 4-year university?
I'm not sure. Like, I would have to reflect on it more. You know, like, I certainly got a lot of my education.
The non-technical courses that you take, right? So the liberal, so-called liberal arts courses. But I guess in a very pragmatic way, right? So the value comes down to a couple of things. Well, obviously, what you learn in the classroom, but honestly, signaling, right? So what school did the person get into? And then the network that you build in college and the friendships. Those are... And so that's why I think maybe a lot of these young people decide, okay, I got into a top school. I met some friends. After a year, I'm out, right?
Yeah. No, it certainly makes sense. Like, I mean, yeah, networks, you know, are valuable for sure. I would like to see education change, though, in light of AI. I mean, it feels like the way that we test people for knowledge and skills doesn't make sense in a lot of ways. And that hasn't changed yet. It's still kind of stuck in the old way. And so if it doesn't change, then I would say it kind of doesn't make sense. So we'll see.
So Hamil, in closing, so obviously people can go to your website, Parlance Labs, but how else can they follow you? Do you teach courses? Do you, and so on and so forth. Where can we follow your work? Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm actually teaching a course with Shreya Shankar. You should look her up or even have her on the podcast. She's a really amazing researcher, educator, and engineer. She's also worked really hard on evals and machine learning systems. And Shreya and I are teaching a course on evals, on domain-specific evals. Very unique. There isn't too much instruction on there on how to do evals. I can give you the link.
We will put that in the episode notes.
Okay.
And with that, thank you, Hamil.
All right, thank you.